Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Watkins Book of English Folk Tales by Neil Philip. Forward by Neil Gaiman. Narrated by Hannibal Hills.
Oh, 'tis a precious apothegmatical pedant who will find matter enough to dilate a whole day of the first invention of fi-fi-fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman. Thomas Nash. Have with you to Saffron Walden, 1596.
Foreword. Folk stories and fairy tales came from somewhere else, not England. That was something I'd learned as a schoolboy. The tales were still ours, of course. It didn't matter where they had originated. They were still performed on stage in panto season by people who sounded like I did, and Cinderella, I knew, must be as English as they come, what with Baron Hardup and Buttons. And for that matter, Aladdin and his wonderful lamp might have been set in ancient Beijing, but the widow Twanky was there to tell us, with a joke about eating fish and chips on the South Parade Pier, that ancient Beijing was incredibly local. Still, proper folk stories were collected by the Brothers Grimm or by Charles Perrault. As I grew up, I'd find collections of folk tales in books from all over the world, from Sweden to Alaska to the Philippines, and began to feel that I'd missed out by being English. I had been raised in a country where stories mattered and had been told, and I knew that too many of those stories were lost, leaving something that was almost a fossil record behind. There were Jack tales, they were English, and I knew about them, and there were local monsters and places in literature that spoke of the places that tales had been. Shakespeare's speeches about fairies, whether Puck or Queen Mab, implied a world of stories mostly lost to us. Dickens parodied local stories filled with goblins, and I wanted to hear the originals. I first read this book about 30 years ago. I had recently moved to the US and missed the England I had left, and I found it in a local bookshop. I loved it, devoured it with delight. It felt alive. Here were stories I had never imagined existing that delighted and astonished me, alongside stories I knew, told in ways I hadn't encountered them before. I read the Snow White story, with three robbers instead of seven dwarves, and it changed the inside of my head. G.K. Chesterton wrote in The Napoleon of Notting Hill that, if you look at a thing 999 times, you are perfectly safe. If you look at it the 1,000th time, you are in frightful danger of seeing it for the first time. And now I knew what he meant. I had read and heard and watched the story of Snow White all my life. One of the first books I remember owning had been a beautifully illustrated Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And yet, the version that Neil Philip gave me here was dissonant enough, real enough, that I looked at the story for the 1,000th time and wrote a version of Snow White called Snow Glass Apples, in which the little princess was a vampire, her prince was a necrophile, and her stepmother was, perhaps, the heroine and the victim. The retelling of Marie Clotilde Balfour's The Flying Childer was a story I had never run into in any form before. It made a huge impression on me, and a few years later I retold it myself in Sandman, illustrated by Charles Vess. It felt alive in ways that I appreciated. A story shape I hadn't encountered. A story of murder and revenge, of a betrayed woman, of children who flew away. It was a strange, dark story. and it delighted me. The way that Lucy Clifford's written, literary story, The New Mother, transmuted into the orally collected story, The Pear Drum, fascinated me and reminded me that every story starts somewhere and starts with someone making it up. Here was Dickens' hilarious take on Bluebeard, Captain Murderer, alongside the haunting tale of The Story of Mr. Fox, another story I would one day retell. Neil Philip has researched assiduously and spread his net wide to create this collection. He had unearthed tales from all across England, stories that resonated, stories that were more than a fossil record of what was left behind, but were a triumphant collection of stories that showed what English stories were. And that was something much more interesting than localized jokes in pantomimes. His commentaries on the stories were enlightening. This is an important collection, and I was thrilled to learn that it would be available once again. But it's better than just an important book. It's a treasure trove of living stories, and enormously fun to read or listen to. Enjoy. Neil Gaiman. Introduction to the 2022 Watkins Edition. The English folktale has entwined itself into English literature. From Chaucer and the Gawain poet to George Peel, William Shakespeare, John Clare, Charles Dickens, and Thomas Hardy. But by the time the original edition of this book came out in 1992, writers with an interest in the deep structure of English folklore, such as Alan Garner and Kevin Crossley Holland, were regarded as outliers. What had folk tales got to do with the worlds of Martin Amis or Julian Barnes or Craig Raine? 30 years later, things seem very different. There is a whole new generation of writers, many of them influenced by Garner, for whom the folktale is the bedrock of narrative. Philip Pullman, Emma Donoghue, Paul Kingsnorth, and Zoe Gilbert are obvious examples. Non-fiction writers such as Robert McFarlane, Carolyn Larrington, Edward Parnell, and Amy Jeffs have also begun to decode England's storied landscape in terms of its folktale heritage. As I was writing and researching this book, there was a remarkable resurgence of oral storytelling in England, spearheaded by Ben Haggerty, Sally Pom Clayton, and Hugh Lupton. Under the auspices of the Crick Crack Club and the Society for Storytelling, this has become a thriving scene, perhaps comparable to the growth of performance poetry. And the writers who have contributed to the Lively History Press series of country-by-country folktale collections, a sample of which was published as The Anthology of English Folktales in 2016, are themselves storytellers, including Hugh Lupton, Kevin Mannering, Sharon Jackstes, and Maureen James. The taking possession of folklore by storytellers rather than scholars has been part of what might be called a rewilding of the English folktale, in which narrators in both oral and written contexts have felt free to both absorb and recast their source material. The most remarkable manifestation of this rewilding has been the creation by David Southwell of the ghost county of Hookland. Much of Hookland's folklore exists as tweets, a very modern way of telling folk tales. He writes, "When we explore place, we get the opportunity to interact with those myth circuits running in the earth, in the stone, get ourselves dirty wading through folklore, that dark sediment of decomposing memory, disturbed by ritual, disturbed by our being in a place." Southwell's insistence that in Hookland nothing is made up, just remembered differently, prompted me to think again about the storyteller Ruth L. Tongue. She was a close friend of the great folklorist Catherine Biggs, and the pair collaborated on Folk Tales of England, 1965, the English volume in Richard Dawson's influential Folk Tales of the World series. Unlike other books in the series, generally sourced from national archives, this volume relied very heavily on a single storyteller, Ruth Tung herself. Tung contributed 42 stories, nearly half the book. My own English Folk Tales contains no stories from Tung. I regard her essentially as a fraud, with her vague attributions to unnamed sources, and her put-on Mummerset dialect. But I see now that her pretense of being a folklore collector was simply a way of remembering differently, and that with her naturally vivid and expressive storytelling style, she was, in fact, making a unique creative contribution to the English folktale. As Bob and Jacqueline Patton wrote, she drew no distinction between collection, recollection, and recreation. Another collector whom I regarded with some suspicion was Marie Clotilde Balfour, a cousin, not aunt, of Robert Louis Stevenson. Her tales from the Lincolnshire Fens in the 1880s were so different in tone and content from anything else collected in Lincolnshire, or indeed in England, that they seemed simply too good to be true. I highlight my doubts in the note to her story, The Flying Childer, though I did choose to include both that and The Green Mist in this book. Since then, a PhD thesis by Maureen James, author of Lincolnshire Folk Tales in the History Press series, has proved conclusively that the stories are genuine folk tradition, recorded by Clotilde Balfour as best she could. James has tentatively identified four of Balfour's storytellers and explains the feverish nature of the stories as a result of regular and excessive consumption of opium. Malaria was endemic in the Fens and widely self-managed with opium. If I had access to James's thesis at the time, I would probably have included a couple more of Balfour's laudanum-drenched fever dreams, such as The Dead Moon and Yallery Brown. One might think that all the stories that were ever going to be collected from English tradition had been already. But folklore has a habit of springing back to life. The most remarkable addition to the canon of faithfully recorded and transcribed English folktales was made in 1997 by Michael Wilson in his Performance and Practice, Oral Narrative Traditions Among Teenagers in Britain and Ireland, which contains, for instance, energetic versions of The Golden Arm and Tom Tit Tot. Tom Tit Tot was collected from 13-year-old Eva Shannon, who heard it from her grandmother. It evidently derives ultimately from the text recorded by Anna Walter Thomas, included in this book. But the tale has taken on a new lease of life in the oral tradition. There is also the case of the two-volume Folk Tales of Newfoundland by Herbert Halpert and J.D.A. Widdowson, 1996. This monumental work shows folk tales that have vanished from English tradition alive and well in Newfoundland. So, for instance, the tale type ATU313, The Magic Flight, which underpins Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, has only been collected twice in England, as Daughter Greengown, both times by T.W. Thompson from English Gypsies, from Reuben Gray in 1914, and Tamie Boswell in 1915. Folk Tales of Newfoundland has versions from six different storytellers, all speaking in West Country English. Wonders will never cease. In short, the English folktale, far from being moribund, is alive and kicking. Introduction. William Hone's Everyday Book, that great 19th century storehouse of the interesting and odd, contains an account written in 1826 of a festival of lying supposed to have been held each May Day at the village of Temple Sowerby in Westmorland, with a hone or whetstone among the prizes. Hone's correspondent, C.T., writes, "There is an anecdote, very current in the place, of a late Bishop of Carlisle passing through in his carriage on this day, when his attention being attracted by the group of persons assembled together, very naturally inquired the cause. His question was readily answered by a false statement of facts, which brought from his lordship a severe lecture on the iniquity of such a proceeding, and at the conclusion he said, 'For my part, I never told a lie in my life.' This was immediately reported to the judges, upon which, without any dissent, the hone was awarded to his lordship, as most deserving of it." This story about telling stories, about telling stories, about telling stories, with its unverifiable claims and its literary form, may stand at the head of any discussion of the complexities of the English folk narrative tradition. Our picture of storytelling in England relies on fragmentary and often unsatisfactory evidence. Of all the major folk literatures, that of England is probably the scantiest. Why this should be is a complex question. It has much to do with what Joseph Jacobs, in the preface to his English Fairy Tales, 1890, discerned as the lamentable gap between the governing and recording classes and the dumb working classes of this country. Dumb to others, but eloquent among themselves. But it is also true that English society did not, except in special cases, provide the community of audience necessary to sustain a thriving storytelling tradition such as that described by J.F. Campbell in his classic Popular Tales of the West Highlands, 1860, with semi-organized story sessions, the first tale by the good man and tales to daylight by the guest. Storytelling in England has tended to be much more informal than this. Stories were told as the occasion arose, as a natural element of daily life, rather than recited to an audience. We might take, as an image of English storytelling, the excursion party in Albert Smith's sub-Dickensian novel Christopher Tadpole, 1848. After the jolly man has told a sensational story of an attempted robbery, such an impetus had been given to the narrative faculties of the van party that they all began to tell stories at once of things that had happened to them, and after this they dropped down to anecdotes and witty sayings, and finally sang songs. This scrappy and disorganized narrative tradition has never been easy to pin down or record. It is true, too, that the English oral tradition was early destabilized by mass semi-literacy and the wide circulation of cheap reading matter, offering the concept of a fixed text in place of the oral storyteller's creative reconstruction. Evidence of this process is clearly marshaled in Margaret Spufford's Small Books and Pleasant Histories, Popular Fiction and Its Readership in 17th Century England, 1981, which uses Pepys's collection of chapbooks to establish the nature of the world of the imagination, fiction and fantasy open to the unlettered reader of the 17th century who had tuppence or threepence to spend. Many of the best-known English tales, such as Jack and the Beanstalk and Jack the Giant Killer, were first, and in some cases only, printed in chapbook form. Victor E. Newberg notes in The Penny Histories, 1968, that the folklore sources of English chapbooks have never been examined. A great deal of work remains to be done in this area. It is important to note here only that while many chapbooks printed stories from English tradition or attenuated versions of medieval romances, the wide circulation of stories from Perrault in chapbook form from the mid-18th century on soon established Perrault's Cinderella and Bluebeard as staple fare in the cottage as well as the nursery. The Northamptonshire poet John Clare, the son of an agricultural labourer and a labourer himself, recalls in The Shepherd's Calendar, 1827, January, a cottage evening, stories told in his childhood, he was born in 1793, as well as tales of fairies and witches and cautionary tales. Clare remembers versions of The Three Heads in the Well, Jack and the Beanstalk, and, significantly, Cinderella. His 20-line version of Cinderella quite clearly derives from Perrault, with its rat, coachman, and pumpkin coach. Equally clearly, it has been modified by English oral tradition. It is, for instance, a glove, not a shoe, that Cinderella loses. This section of Clare's Shepherd's Calendar is the most detailed and vivid description we possess of the tradition of oral storytelling in England. Not only what was told, but the circumstances of telling. Clare describes only women as storytellers in the home setting. Things cleared away, then down she sits, and tells her tales by starts and fits. Not willing to lose time or toil, she knits or sews, and talks the while. The children cringe away to bed, fearful of the terrors they have heard about. Clare says, 1824, of these stories, "I hear them told to children still." In his poem St. Martin's Eve, of about the same date, he describes, interestingly, folk tales being read to a rural audience, almost certainly from the chapbook The History of the Four Kings. Clare did attempt to record the folk song tradition of his neighbourhood, but although according to Clare's first biographer, Frederick Martin, 1865, Clare's father not only knew above 100 ballads, but also had a stock of ghost stories and fairy tales that was quite inexhaustible, no stories survive. Quite frequently, singers will also have been storytellers. The singer Henry Burstow, some of whose songs were collected by Lucy Broadwood and Ralph Vaughan Williams, writes in his autobiography, Reminiscences of Horsham, 1911, that, "I inherited a tenacious memory, to which from babyhood upwards I committed particulars of numerous events and incidents, tales and songs." Had English folk tales ever been pursued with the same vigour as folk songs, we might now be able to study them with something like the same thoroughness and confidence. But the only folk song collector also to collect stories was the Reverend Sabine Baring Gould, who contributed 16 stories as an appendix to William Henderson's Notes on the Folklore of the Northern Counties of England and the Borders, 1866. These include, for instance, The Rose Tree, an English version of the story known as the Grimm's Juniper Tree. Accompanying Baring Gould's story texts was an early attempt at classification of tales by means of story radicals. Folklorists now use a classification system invented by the Finn Antti Aarne and developed by the American Stith Thompson, the Types of the Folk Tale. The Rose Tree is a version of Aarne Thompson, A.T., 720, My Father Slew Me, My Mother Ate Me. Besides the tale type index of Aarne and Thompson, scholars also refer to small units of narrative by the numbers assigned to them in Thompson's Motif Index of Folk Literature. These indexes, and the others formed on their pattern, are indispensable for the comparative study of folk tales. The best introduction to their use is Thompson's own study of The Folk Tale, 1946. Ernest Bauman's Type and Motif Index of the Folk Tales of England and North America, 1966, applies their techniques to the English language material and is a very valuable tool. It is important, though, to realize that these classification systems are tools, not ends in themselves. Developed to assist the Finnish historic geographic method of folktale research, which seeks to establish a life history for each tale by tracking back from version to version, the Arne Thompson Index has encouraged scholars to think of story as something that inheres in the plot rather than in the words, images, and performance. It is foolish to imagine that the Platonic type is more important than the individual, possibly clumsy and muddled, variant. This is certainly never true for either teller or audience, who are the only significant parties to any storytelling transaction. Best, perhaps, to speak not of a story, but of a narration. For an orally transmitted tale is not a fixed thing like a static printed text. It is fluid, changeable, alive. Each narration is a separate event. If we record or report a spoken story, what we have on paper is evidence of storytelling rather than the story itself. We do have such evidence for England, as Catherine Briggs's monumental Dictionary of British Folk Tales in the English Language, 1970-71, the central repository of texts, shows. But it is evidence which, to be properly understood, needs to be questioned and replaced in a context it is now almost impossible to supply, save by close reading of accounts such as John Clare's. As a brief indication of the problems involved in assessing the texts of English folktale narrations, I will examine briefly the four stories in Joseph Jacobs's English Fairy Tales that he claims to have been, in their original texts, taken down from the mouths of the peasantry. The first is Jack and His Golden Snuffbox, from Francis Hines Groom's In Gypsy Tents, 1880. Far from being an English peasant, the narrator of this story was a Welsh gypsy, John Roberts. Far from being taken down from his mouth, the story was written down by the narrator himself. Far from being told in English, Groom's text is translated from the narrator's Romany. Next, Jacobs offers Tom Tit Tot and Kappa Rushes. While these are indeed remarkably lively and robust, they were written down by Anna Walter Thomas from memories of the storytelling of her old nurse over 20 years after the event. The original narrator is neither named nor described. Fourth is the version of The Three Big Sillies, supplied to the Folklore Journal in 1884 by Charlotte Byrne, about which the only information given is that it was told in 1862 and afterwards by a nursemaid then aged 16, a native of Horton near Stafford. Again, we have a 20-year gap for time and folklore scholarship to efface memory. These four tales, remember, are the best that Joseph Jacobs, the leading authority of his day, could come up with in 1890 as English folk tales that have been taken down from the lips of the peasantry. It is a matter for regret that Jacobs never published the scholarly study of the English folk tale that he promised, and which he was uniquely qualified to write, and that the planned narrative volume of the Gomes projected Dictionary of British Folklore came to nothing. Instead, the English folktale had to wait for F. J. Norton, whose painstaking manuscript collection forms the basis of the Briggs Dictionary, for a properly diligent and informed survey. In the meantime, the man whom I consider the greatest of all English folktale collectors, had embarked on and abandoned his work entirely in the dark, pleading vainly in the Journal of the Gypsy Law Society for help from...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?